Welcome back.
Starry, starry night. Paint your palette blue and gray.
Okay, everyone's probably doing that, but we just had to. It's so beautiful. And now we know that it's a lot starrier than Don McLean or any of us ever thought. If you're counting, astronomers now say the universe holds 300 sextillion stars. That's a three with 23 zeros, three times the number they previously calculated. Joining us to try to help us wrap our heads around this celestial news and much more is our resident sky watcher, Kelly Beattie. Kelly, welcome as always.
Hey, Robin.
So your response to this?
Well, it's an interesting approach to trying to get a handle around how many stars there really are. And astronomers have had to guesstimate this all along based on how many stars there are in the Milky Way. We look around the Milky Way, our home galaxy, and we figure there are, maybe 200 to 400 billion stars. And then we look to see how many galaxies there are. And an estimate of that is, again, 200 or so billion galaxies. So you multiply those together and you get a number. The problem is we can't actually see the stars in the other galaxies, so it's something of a guess. It's like doing the census using Texas as the basis for all the other states, and it just doesn't work.
Well, how can we solve them now?
So it turns out that there is a kind of star called a red dwarf. It's smaller than the sun by a lot. It's an old star. It's a dim star, and it gives off a kind of light, a spectrum that is very distinctive and all its own. So these astronomers that did this study saw this spectrum in these other galaxies and concluded, based on the strength of it, that there must be far more red dwarfs, up to 80% of all the stars in some of these other galaxies, than had been thought before. And so you take those new numbers and you end up with lots more stars, most of which are these tiny red dwarfs.
So the fault lies not in the stars, but with us in our calculating. I'm sorry, you're going to hear a lot of this.
But in our telescopes.
Right, but what does it mean? I mean, the teenage sons of one of our staff members said, yes, so. So what does it mean?
Right, so, we're trying to understand how galaxies formed in the first place, which was many billions of years ago. And we have really only one good example that we can see up close and personal, that's our own. So astronomers have a sort of model for how the Milky Way formed. And what this new discovery has the potential to do is to teach us that, the formation of galaxies all those billions of years ago was a very complicated process, and there wasn't just one right path to galaxyhood. And that may cause us to rethink how we imagine those galaxies formed, what the conditions were in the early universe soon after the Big Bang that caused them to form. It has universal implications.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, it's going to send high school science book editors running to make changes, as will the other news that came out this week. The chemical elements essential for life as we know it, all because of an announcement yesterday from NASA. What did they find?
They found that there is a kind of bacteria discovered in Mono Lake, which is a brackish lake in interior California, that uses arsenic as part of its molecular structure. Now, I need to back up a step.
Yeah.
All life as we know it uses six essential elements: carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, and phosphorus. Well, these bacteria, instead of phosphorus, they have arsenic in their genetic makeup, in their DNA, in their proteins. And so it appears that there is either these bacteria started out normal, and because of the conditions in the lake, there's not much phosphorus, there's a lot of arsenic, over time used arsenic, or they started out with arsenic to begin with as part of their molecular makeup. If it's the latter, this could have big implications for, there's talk of shadow biospheres, whole colonies of life that have not been detected yet because of this arsenic phosphorus swap. Now, the thing is, it tells us more broadly that life is much stranger than we imagined it to be.
Which is pretty strange to start for someone trying to grasp
with
this.
I mean, there are biomes that live off of methane and don't have to be in the sun and so forth. And so when you take that and you imagine yourself going out into the universe to search for life, it says to the scientists, hey, you better be prepared to look for everything. An analogy that I came up with, the late Carl Sagan once imagined that life could be based on silicon instead of carbon because those two elements are very similar. In this same way, these scientists have found that phosphorus can be substituted for by arsenic, and maybe there are others as well.
Well, a couple questions. How did arsenic get in the lake? And we think of arsenic as something that kills people. So how is it giving life?
Right. So you're absolutely right. Arsenic can kill people. It reacts with proteins in the body called thiols, which are kind of related to alcohols. But that's the arsenic ion. When you create a salt out of it, as the body does for its genetic construction, it's more benign. And so in this lake, Mono Lake, I've been there. It's not a place you want to go swimming. It's a really brackish, completely devoid of oxygen. It's a landlocked lake. And so there is a lot of arsenic in this water, and there is not a lot of phosphorus. And there had been hints that something like this was going to turn up. A few years ago, scientists had found bacteria in this water that utilized arsenic in some ways for cell production, but not as part of the actual makeup of the cell itself. And so this does represent a big leap.
Yeah. And by the way, we should note NASA astrobiologist Felisa Wolf-Simon was the one who scooped up this bacterium from this brackish lake and made this discovery. Well, how about something that's a little more that we can wrap our brains around? A big date coming up, December 21st, looking skyward.
Right. So most people, perhaps December 21st rings a bell because it's typically the date of the winter solstice, as it will be this year as well. That's the time when, winter officially begins, even though it's pretty cold by then anyway. It's the shortest daylight hours of the year. On the morning of the 21st, there'll be a total eclipse of the moon. That is, the moon will duck into Earth's shadow for the first time in nearly 3 years. And so a full moon over a course of a couple of hours will disappear and then reappear again. And North America happens to be in the front row seats for this. That's the good news. The bad news is the timing. In order to see this here on the East Coast, we'll need to be up at 3 in the morning. From roughly, 2:40 to 3:50 in the morning. If you're out on the Pacific Coast, it's a little earlier, like, a little before midnight until after midnight. So It'll be a great event. It's one of those things we always look forward to seeing.
Okay. Well, I would have chosen total eclipse of the moon, but we have chosen something else to salute you, Kelly Beatty. You always help us understand things going on in the sky. Kelly Beatty, a senior contributing editor at Sky and Telescope magazine. For more on all of this new information, that just in a couple seconds we have, are scientists sort of reeling from all this new information this week?
Oh, and science writers, let me tell you. Yeah. We can't hardly keep up with it. And, astronomy is a great science. There are things happening in it all the time. And it's just the pace of discovery is fantastic right now.
Well, for more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Kelly, thanks as always.
Oh, always a pleasure, Robin.
Back in a minute, Here and Now.
The lunatic is in my head. The lunatic is in my head. You raise the blade.